perhaps parabolic, and made up of an array of at least 24 hinged, movable mirrors rather than just one. Presumably, the mirrors would be large and cast of polished bronze. To this day, mechanical engineers, teenage science fair types, and TV crews stage the occasional simulation of Archimedes' endeavor, some resulting in out-and-out failure, some in qualified success. Despite astronomy's growing practicality, celestial events could still provide a potent magical kick. Sometimes they even swayed the course of history. Rulers could be dethroned because of a comet or a supernova. Battles were launched, won, lost, or abandoned because of an eclipse. The day Odysseus rejoined his waiting and presumably widowed wife and slaughtered the hordes of suitors who had been hanging out at his house may well have coincided with a noontime eclipse in 1178 B.C. And Herodotus, the 5th century B.C. war historian, travel writer, and investigative reporter, recounts the effect of an eclipse during the 6th year of battle between the Lydians and the Medes. The participants, he writes, were so shocked to see day on a sudden changed into night that both sides stopped fighting and started negotiating. Modern eclipse calculations, based on celestial mechanics, yield a precise date for that armistice, May 28, 585 BC at about 7:30 p.m. While the time of an ancient event is often uncertain, its location is typically well documented. For this reason, total solar eclipses have served as a type of laboratory, permitting a comparison between where you would have expected to see a given eclipse based on the assumption that Earth's rotation rate has been constant over the millennia and where the eclipse was actually observed on Earth. That these turn out to be two different locations on our planet's surface offers incontrovertible evidence that Earth's rotation rate has been slowing down, primarily due to friction from oceanic tides sloshing on our continental shelves. In modern times, this phenomenon is well known and well measured, which has led to the occasional addition of a leap second to the calendar. While many ancient writers, no strangers to war, discussed the military advantage afforded by astronomy, Socrates discounts it. In Plato's Republic, written 24 centuries ago, before Archimedes and his mirrors, Socrates and Glaucon debate which branches of knowledge would be useful to the rulers of Athens. Socrates contends, in Book 7, that the most valuable branches have a double use, military and philosophical, and that a firm command of arithmetic and geometry is essential both for war and for the soul. Glaucon replies that astronomy, by which he means the observation of the seasons, months, and years, is as useful to the general as to the farmer or the sailor. But Socrates doesn't agree. To him, astronomy is too wedded to observation, too dependent on the senses, and therefore antithetical to noble philosophy. 2 centuries later, in the section of his histories titled On the Art of a Commander, the Greek politician historian Polybius ranks astronomy up alongside geometry, elaborating on the importance of knowing the movements and positions of the sun, the moon, and the constellations of the zodiac, he writes, "It is time, indeed, which rules all human action, and especially the affairs of war, so that a general must be familiar with the dates of the summer and winter solstices and the equinoxes, and with the rate of increase and decrease of days and nights between these. For by no other means can he compute correctly the distances he will be able to traverse either by sea or land. He must also be acquainted with the subdivisions of day and night, so as to know when to sound the reveille and to be on the march. For it is impossible to obtain a happy end unless the beginning is happily timed." Neglect these matters, warns Polybius, and you'll make a mess of things. Bad timing is fatal. To prove his point, he cites a number of examples, including a precipitous decision taken on August 27, 413 BC, during the siege of Syracuse, a major campaign of the Peloponnesian War, though not the siege of Syracuse in which Archimedes is said to have deployed his mirrors. Nicias, again, the Athenian general, could have saved the army before Syracuse, and had fixed on the proper hour of the night to withdraw into a position of safety, unobserved by the enemy. But on an eclipse of the moon taking place, he was struck with terror, as if it foreboded some calamity, and deferred his departure. The consequence of this was that when he abandoned his camp on the following night, the enemy had divined his intention, and both the army and the generals were made prisoners by the Syracusans. Yet had he only inquired from men acquainted with astronomy, so far from throwing away his opportunity owing to such an occurrence, he could have utilized the ignorance of the enemy. It's hard to avoid lunar eclipses. When they occur, on average every couple of years, they last hours, and the entire half of Earth facing the moon will witness them. That's because, unlike a total solar eclipse, an event that takes place on Earth's surface, a total lunar eclipse takes place in space, with the full moon entering Earth's shadow. In fact, in ancient Greece and Rome, the intelligentsia already understood that, as Alan Bowen, a historian of the exact sciences in the classical world, puts it. The antidote to the fear induced in the ignorant at the occurrence of an eclipse is learning that eclipses take place in the regular course of nature and are not omens or signs from the gods. During his fourth voyage to the New World, Christopher Columbus decided that an upcoming lunar eclipse would be a good way to threaten the locals on Hispaniola, who, because they produced almost no excess food, had been unable to supply Columbus with enough provisions to ensure that his crew remained loyal to him. He warned the locals that God, punisher of evildoers, would make the moon disappear if they did not hand over more food. He even specified when this would happen. Divine wrath aside, Columbus, being familiar with recently compiled eclipse tables, knew that astronomy would back up his threat. February 29, 1504 would be the night. The 18th century British historian Edward Drake relates the incident. Knowing that there would be an eclipse of the moon within 3 days, Columbus sent an Indian who spoke Spanish to assemble the community on an affair of the utmost importance to their welfare. Being met on the day preceding the eclipse, the Indian told them that the Christians believed in God who made heaven and earth and who was angry with them for not supplying his distressed servants with provisions and would therefore chastise them with famine and other calamities, and, as a proof that what he told them was true, they should that very night observe the moon rising with a bloody aspect as a warning of the punishment God would inflict upon them. The eclipse beginning as soon as the moon was up, and the darkness continuing to increase, it put them in such a consternation that they hastened to entreat the admiral that he would pray to God to be no longer angry with them, and they would bring as much provisions as he would have occasion for. Retiring to his cabin, Columbus shut himself up till the eclipse was at its height, when he came out and told them he had prayed for them, promising they would be good, whereupon God had forgiven them, and they should see the moon by degrees recover her usual appearance. 14 centuries before Columbus, Ptolemy had supplied the mathematics needed to compute the timing, magnitude, and duration of eclipses. Nevertheless, to the unlettered, they continued to seem special and portentous. In fact, every event and feature in the heavens, whether special or ordinary, has long been regarded as relevant to or even directly causal for the affairs of humans on Earth, if only its meaning could be divined. Enter astrology. For the Mesopotamians, astrology and astronomy were more or less the same thing. For the emperors of ancient China, as for the ancient Greeks, astrology and astronomy were intertwined. The skies spoke. The sky watcher listened and translated. Copernicus did astrology. Tycho Brahe did astrology. The great Galileo did astrology. Johannes Kepler, though critical of many aspects of astrology and aware of its cynical use, cast hundreds of horoscopes. In 1601, just after becoming imperial mathematician to the Holy Roman Emperor Rudolf II, Kepler published a treatise entitled Concerning the More Certain Fundamentals of Astrology. A quarter century later, he served as astrologer to General Albrecht von Wallenstein. The modern distinction between astronomy and astrology was at one time fuzzy and irrelevant, just like the distinction between alchemy and chemistry, or between magic and medicine. Promoting the propitious, avoiding calamity, and forecasting death suggest astrological interpretation. Yet prediction, which is an offshoot of analysis, can be exacting and scientific given the right practitioner. Accurate observation of the skies, combined with a grasp of physics and a cartography of the cosmos, is the cornerstone of both. Claudius Ptolemy, a renowned 2nd century AD Alexandrian mathematician, addressed all of the above. Besides writing astronomy's formidable founding document, the Almagest, he wrote the influential compilation of the geographical and cartographical knowledge of his day, the Geographici Hypheges, and the equally influential astrology opus, the Tetrabiblos. He begins Tetrabiblos by asserting a link between sky and earth and the dual nature of sky studies. Of the means of prediction through astronomy, two are the most important and valid. One, which is first both in order and in effectiveness, is that whereby we apprehend the aspects of the movements of sun, moon, and stars in relation to each other and to the earth, as they occur from time to time. The second is that in which by means of the natural character of these aspects themselves, we investigate the changes which they bring about in that which they surround. Ptolemy did not doubt that the cosmos was a unified, harmonious system. The Greek word cosmos means order, as well as world. Or that the celestial affected the terrestrial. He traced a natural progression from heavenly configurations within and among the zodiacal constellations to the differing strengths of their influence on different sectors of Earth, to the general temperaments of persons born in those sectors, to the particular temperaments of persons born at particular times when particular influences were prominent. The sky was the seal that stamped the wax. By calculating where everything was, is, and will be on the sky, the astrologer could assign cause, preferably before, but sometimes after, the effect. Excesses of the body, flaws and felicities of character, distresses of the soul, and disruptions of society and nature could be traced to a source. Jupiter and Venus were temperate and moistening, hence fertile, active, and beneficent. Saturn and Mars were chilling and drying, hence destructive. Leo the Lion, the Sun, Mars, Saturn, and Jupiter embodied masculinity. Virgo the Virgin, the Moon, and Venus embodied femininity. Europe, the northwestern quadrant of the known world, was familiar with Leo, Aries the Ram, and Sagittarius the Centaur Archer, and was governed by Jupiter and Mars. Therefore, wrote Ptolemy, the men there were warlike, commanding, clean, fond of liberty, and indifferent to women. The inhabitants of Britain and Germany, he added, were especially fierce because of their greater familiarity with Aries and Mars. Your horoscope, hora, hour, scopos, watcher, which derived from the sun's location among the stars at the time of your birth, delineated your basic individual tendencies. In addition, the changing skies triggered changing effects. Knowing your own as well as the planet's proclivities, you could calmly prepare yourself for what lay ahead and, if necessary, rein in your worst tendencies so as to reduce your risk. Events and cities were subject to similar influences. While celestial configurations predisposed an individual to violence or acquiescence and a polity to peace or endless strife, they could also signal a coming shipwreck, earthquake, or robbery, or suggest the most advantageous timing for a marriage, a coronation, a prayer, or an invasion. The influence of classical astrology lasted for centuries. Astrologers cast horoscopes not only for Jesus and Pope Urban VIII, but also for the fate of Florence and Rome and for the belligerent parties in World War I. They predicted or retroactively explained the assassination of monarchs, the success of empires, the rise of religions, even the end of history. Not that everybody thought Ptolemy's legacy was a good thing. Astrologers, contended the critics, usurped power that rightly belonged to others. Horoscopes were too persuasive. Even Ptolemy himself had reservations. Hardly had the ink of Tetrabiblos dried than astrologers began to be expelled from Rome. The practice of astrology was restricted or even banned by the emperors Augustus, Diocletian, Theodosius, and Justinian. St. Augustine said it was untenable to propose that the stars, whose power derived from God, could cause evil. Martin Luther pointed out that numerous astrologers had predicted a great flood of 1524, which didn't happen, whereas none predicted the massive peasants' revolt of 1524-25, which did. Urban VIII, whose death had been misforecast for 1630 by a renowned abbot astrologer, issued a papal bull against astrologers in 1631. But even vocal opponents of astrology sometimes played it safe. Francesco Guicciardini, a politician in Renaissance Florence who ridiculed the widespread tendency to remember astrologers' successes while forgetting their far more numerous mistakes, had his own horoscope cast by a murderer. Nor did astrology vanish with the rise of rationalism or the increasing interest in observational astronomy or the spread of the telescope, despite the sudden appearance of brilliant new stars, supernovas, in 1572 and 1604. Not to mention Galileo's discoveries in 1609 and 1610 of the mountains and craters of the moon, the four largest satellites of Jupiter, and the two seeming companions of Saturn, all of which made astrology's foundations tremble. Suddenly the map of the sky, and consequently the analysis of celestial influences, had to be revised. William Herschel's discovery in 1781 that Uranus was a planet further confounded the profession. Beliefs, however, have a strong grip. Although many educated Europeans came to reject celestial determinism in the lives of individuals, many continued to embrace the idea that the stars and planets affect the more general course of nature. Diplomats advised a limited reliance on astrology rather than an all-out rejection of it, especially in times of war. The English philosopher-scientist Francis Bacon discounted the doctrine of horoscopes and felt astrology to be so full of superstition that scarce anything sound can be discovered in it, yet declared that purifying it was preferable to discarding it altogether. Britain's first astronomer royal, John Flamsteed, trod lightly on astrologers' toes, referring to the rare triad of Saturn-Jupiter conjunctions in 1682-83, he wrote that while astrologers had affrighted the common people with fearful predictions of direful events, the more judicious are desirous to know how often and at what time their conjunctions happen. Galileo, too, was caught between the old and the new. He himself drew up horoscopes for his friends, his daughters, his patrons, himself. The dedication of his paradigm-destroying Sidereus Nuncius, published in March 1610, includes a panegyric to Jupiter and to his patron Cosimo II de' Medici, whose horoscope Galileo slightly rigged to make that regal planet maximally dominant. Astrological prognostication kept its hold well into the 17th century. After enduring a few body blows in the 18th century, it gained ground in the 19th, survived the 20th, and is alive and well across the globe in the 21st, especially among those with limited science literacy. Few people, including those who hold power, are immune to the suspicion that astrology might have something to offer or to swear by. Take America. For most of the past 30 years, the fraction of the U.S. population that embraces astrology has held steady at 1/4, but is now growing. About the same fraction believes in reincarnation, while twice as many have had what they call a mystical experience. While Ronald Reagan was president, he and his wife Nancy consulted a Vassar grad astrologer who prescribed the timing, sometimes right down to the second, of presidential election debates, the announcement of Justice Anthony Kennedy's appointment to the Supreme Court, press conferences, takeoffs of Air Force One, State of the Union addresses, and much else. Right after 9/11, a prophecy, ostensibly written by the illustrious obscurantist, 16th century astrologer, and seer Nostradamus, raced across the internet, further terrifying masses of already terrified Americans and further priming them for retaliation. In fact, the quatrain was an intentional fabrication written for a 20th century student essay, Two Brothers Torn Apart by Chaos, While the Fortress Endures, the Great Leader Will Succumb, the Third Big War Will Begin When the Big City is Burning. Embellishments soon included, on the 11th day of the 9th month, two metal birds will crash into two tall statues, and in the city of York there will be a great collapse. In 2004, after several years of intensive fear promotion by media and public officials alike, the most popular search term on AOL was horoscope. On the night of September 4th, 2008, as a vast screen video introduced John McCain to the party faithful at the Republican National Convention, to the accompaniment of swelling music and applause, a sonorous voiceover proclaimed, "The stars are aligned. Change will come." Or take India, where astrology is Vedic rather than Ptolemaic, and the moon figures more prominently than the sun in horoscopes. Today, as in the past, few Hindus marry without consulting and obeying an astrologer. As the diplomat, journalist, and writer Kushvant Singh put it, astronomical harmony was the one guarantee of happiness. On November 27, 2003, 12,000 couples got married in New Delhi because Jupiter's planetary mischief would be kept at bay that night. In late October and early November 2006, Delhi was again awash in weddings. This time because even couples whose discordant horoscopes would normally rule out a marriage were being assured of a happy outcome. But matters of matrimony are far from the only domain where astrology rules. Political candidates' nomination papers are filed and the winners are sworn in at astrologically opportune times. In 2001, with the Bhartiya Janata Party in power, publicly funded Indian universities were urged to offer courses in Vedic astrology. Many Indian scientists and academics vilified the policy, for our government to send satellites into space yet permit astrology to be taught using public funds is too great a contradiction to bear further mention. But it was upheld by the Supreme Court of India. In his panoramic 2007 novel, Sacred Games, now a Netflix series, Indian-American writer and computer geek Vikram Chandra offers an extraordinary depiction of astrology wedded to annihilation. One of his characters is a guru whose goal is to engineer the nuclear annihilation of the city so as to start Earth's cycle of time and life afresh. Speaking to a gang kingpin who has become his disciple, he says, "Think of life itself. Do you think it has no violence in it? Life feeds on life, Ganesh. And the beginning of life is violence. Do you know where our energy comes from? The sun, you say. Everything depends on the sun. We live because of the sun. But the sun is not a peaceful place. It is a place of unbelievable violence. It is one huge explosion, a chain of explosions. When the violence ceases, the sun dies, and we die. Have not holy men fought before? Have they not urged warriors to battle? Does spiritual advancement mean that you should not take up weapons when confronted by evil? We must resist this so-called peace, which emasculates spirituality and makes it weak." Money, an overwhelmingly obvious source of power, is another matter in which astrologers are hard at work. Read the business press, and you're likely to run across a quote from the economist John Kenneth Galbraith. "The only function of economic forecasting is to make astrology look respectable." But plenty of people seem to feel that money is power, and that astrology is control, and that if you put the two together, you've got control over money. The Gilded Age banking magnate John Pierpont Morgan reputedly said, "Millionaires don't hire astrologers, but billionaires do." Both Morgan and Seymour Cromwell, president of the New York Stock Exchange from 1921 to 1924, consulted a high-profile astrologer named Evangeline Adams, who received her clients in a suite above Carnegie Hall. More recent financial astrologers' mottos and book titles may give skeptics pause. Market Timing by Planetary Cycles and Technical Analysis. Planetary Harmonics of Speculative Markets. But investors, fund managers, bankers, and corporate executives still seek their advice. Statistically, of course, amid all the misses, there's the occasional hit. One astrologer forecast that the stock market would plummet in October 1987. Another forecast that gold would hit $487 an ounce in 2005. Horoscopes can be, and are, drawn up for a bond, a treasury bill, a company, or even a stock exchange, based on the hour of its first offering, or its incorporation, or the start of trading. Astrologers were, no doubt, heartened by the findings of two business school professors to the effect that across the full history of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the S&P 500, the NYSE, and the NASDAQ, stock returns have been as much as 8% higher, about double, for the 15 days around the new moon than for the 15 days around the full moon. Elsewhere, the lunar cycle effect has been even more pronounced. For the final three decades of the 20th century, in stock exchanges around the world, the returns were as much as 10% higher. Meanwhile, the half month surrounding the new moon generates, on average, the same gravity and the same tidal forces as the half month that surrounds the full moon. One classical scientific astrologer and financial commentator has stressed planetary transits and oppositions rather than the phases of the moon. Posting his analyses in the late summer of 2007, amid the deepening credit crunch, the flood of home foreclosures and bank failures, and the ubiquitous, though widely ignored, signs of imminent global economic meltdown, Theodore White warned of the bursting housing bubble, contending that Jupiter helped inflate values and that Saturn had begun to deflate them. Saturn's long transit of Virgo, 26 months, and another 4 months by retrograde in the year 2010, takes place in a sign ruled by Mercury, he wrote. This transit will have a devastating, nearly depressing effect on those severely affected by the downturn in the housing market nationwide. In addition, Saturn would be rising in sunrise diurnal charts and will be lord of the months of October and November, with continuing strong influences into December 2007. The latter's transit near the South Lunar Node pointed to the subprime mortgage crisis crystallizing into a major call for regulation throughout the economic climate of the United States. After-the-fact revelations are easy to come by when you consult the nearly limitless number of cyclic phenomena. It's not hard to find one that matches your needs or expectations. There's the 11-year sunspot cycle, the 26-month cycle of Earth and Mars in space, the 18.6-year cycle of lunar eclipses. There's also the yearly cycle of months in 1907, 1929, 1987, and 2008. The stock market sustained huge hits in October. Other Octobers saw pullbacks. Does that mean the October effect is a real thing? No. But if significant numbers of buyers and sellers believe that cosmic forces will bring down the market, a sell-off will follow, thereby fulfilling their prediction. Plus, keep in mind all the failed predictions. The prosecution of war is at least as durable and hard-nosed a pursuit as the acquisition of a fortune, and certain real-life warriors have been as interested in astrology as were the rulers of Mesopotamia and ancient China. Nazi Germany offers a stunning case study, chronicled in detail by Elik Howe, a writer, historian, and expert forger who, during World War II, worked for a British agency called the Political Warfare Executive. Interest in astrology rose rapidly in defeated, inflated Germany following World War I, writes Howe, more rapidly than in the rest of Europe. A graphologist journalist named Elsbeth Ebertin was fast becoming a well-paid, widely read professional astrologer. And in the spring of 1923, a follower of Adolf Hitler's, hoping to learn about his leader's horoscope, sent Ebertin the rising politician's date of birth, though not the exact hour, a crucial detail. Ebertin decided to publish the horoscope in the 1924 edition of her annual almanac, A Glance into the Future. She did not name Hitler, but she didn't have to. A man of action, born on 20 April 1889, with sun in 29 degrees Aries at the time of his birth, can expose himself to personal danger by excessively uncautious action and could very likely trigger off an uncontrollable crisis. His constellations show that this man is to be taken very seriously indeed. He is destined to play a Führer role in future battles. It seems that the man I have in mind with this strong Aries influence is destined to sacrifice himself for the German nation, also to face up to all circumstances with audacity and courage, even when it is a matter of life and death, and to give an impulse which will burst forth quite suddenly to a German freedom movement. But I will not anticipate destiny. Ebertin's prognosis, calculated on the assumption of a noonday birth, appeared in July 1923. In November, Hitler participated in what could easily qualify as an excessively uncautious action, the Beer Hall Putsch. By the time he landed in jail for his part in the putsch, Ebertin had learned that he'd been born at 6:30 p.m. No matter. Astrology's star was rising in Germany, aglow with swiftly multiplying societies, publishers, manuals, conferences, and adherents of every sort. More than 100 Herren Doktoren, philosophers, paleontologists, physicians, even an astronomer who worked on ballistics problems and possibly the dreaded V-2 rocket, publicly joined their ranks. As Howe put it, in Germany, between the two wars, there were more astrologers per square mile than anywhere else in the world. Popular as it was, astrology also spawned powerful opponents. With Hitler's appointment as Chancellor of the Third Reich on January 30, 1933, his horoscope became a matter of wider interest. Aiming to justify various characterizations of the Führer, some astrologers even corrected the hour of his birth, putting the sun in Taurus rather than in Aries, and, in a few cases, questioning his capacities. The authorities saw that as a line in the sand. In the spring of 1934, the Berlin police banned most forms of astrological activity, and by the end of the year, the Reich Ministry for Propaganda and Public Enlightenment, headed by Dr. Paul Joseph Goebbels, had silenced public astrological speculation concerning the fortunes of the Third Reich and the horoscopes of prominent Nazis. Astrological literature, both popular and abstruse, was confiscated from publishers and booksellers. Homes were searched, persons arrested. The last major annual astrological conference took place in 1936. One after another, periodicals ceased publication during 1937 and 1938. Late in the afternoon on May 10, 1941, coincidentally, a few hours before the most horrific night of the London Blitz, the mentally unstable Rudolf Hess, occupant of the third highest leadership position in the Third Reich, and, like so many of his countrymen, something of an aficionado of astrology, climbed into a Messerschmitt 110 fighter plane and headed for Scotland. He had secretly decided to embark on a peculiar, unvetted mission of peace, trying to convince British high officials to accept German supremacy in Europe and thereby save their country from further devastation. Practicalities soon intervened. The plane's fuel supply wasn't sufficient for the trip, so he had to bail out, leaving the plane to crash onto a farmer's field near Glasgow while he himself parachuted down, breaking his ankle and ending up in a British military hospital. Reich officials, needing to produce an explanation for the surprise flight that would somehow satisfy not only the German people but also the rest of the world, decided to blame a combination of insanity and astrology. Rumors flew around Europe. The London Times posited that Hess was Hitler's secret personal astrologer. Propagandists on both sides went into overdrive. Within a couple of days, the Gestapo arrested and questioned several astrologers. Within the month, they arrested hundreds more, primarily those who belonged to astrological societies and who had published their analyses, along with many more people involved in activities tinged with the occult. On June 24th, public lectures and performances involving astrology, clairvoyance, telepathy, and other esoteric practices were thenceforth forbidden. On October 3rd, the ban was extended to the print media. Some astrologers ended up in concentration camps. Yet despite the considerable censorship, astrology and the occult flourished behind both closed and open doors, supported in part by Goebbels. On November 22, 1939, at one of his almost daily ministerial conferences, convened for the attendees to assent, not confer, he decreed that a psyops leaflet based on Nostradamus's prophesying of the far future be swiftly prepared for dissemination in France. In 1940, the propaganda ministry hired Karl Ernst Kraft, a fervent, statistics-minded Swiss astrologer, to annotate selections from Nostradamus. In 1942 through 1943, chastened by a few months of incarceration following the Hess affair, Kraft and another notable, though more pragmatic, astrologer named F.G. Gerner were conscripted to spend their days excerpting Nostradamus and preparing the horoscopes of allied generals. Other recently arrested astrologers, along with astronomers, mathematicians, and psychics, were recruited for the Pendulum Institute, where, during the spring of 1942, under the directorship of a captain of the German Navy, the professional staff assiduously swung pendulums over maps of the Atlantic Ocean, searching for the positions of enemy ships. As the Reich's fortunes wavered, the drafting of prophecies and the private study of horoscopes mounted. Publicly, prediction became the general order of the day, at least while it remained useful, and radio was the propagandist's preferred medium. From September 1942 through March 1943, the second winter of the campaign in Russia, nearly one in every eight items in the German news bulletins was an explicit prediction. Refugee German intellectuals described the Nazis' approach to prediction and prophecy. Belligerent governments invariably predict victory. The stakes are high, and the public is naturally anxious. Not to predict is to encourage suspicion and to destroy confidence. To predict ultimate failure is morally to surrender. Thus, propagandists predict victory, for it is the only thing they can do. Above all, the leader is forced to prophesy to demonstrate his charismatic gift. Reassurance is given by initial victories. As time went on, however, the propagandist found it convenient to deal with the increased tension of the German people by an increased use of predictions. There is a greater need to predict in times of distress rather than in times of comfort. For a long time, predictions took the place of good news. But when Russia's force remained unbroken, the policy was suddenly changed, and prediction became rare. It was at this time that Goebbels began telling the German people in so many words that this was a world in which one could not predict, and that the war was simply the riddle of riddles. The specifically astrological form of prediction, however, retained its appeal. From the late 1930s onward, rumors about a Hitler astrology connection multiplied. One astrologically sophisticated writer, Louis de Wahl, a part Jewish Berliner who got himself out of Germany in 1935 and wished to survive in style in London and New York, found astrology a convenient way to facilitate his survival, and so he let it be known that Kraft was Hitler's personal astrologer. The president of Columbia University soon announced that Hitler had a team of five astrologers. The London Evening Standard named Elsbeth Ebertine the Führer's favorite astrologer. In fact, neither Hitler nor most of his closest Nazi colleagues turned to astrologers for advice on what to do, when, even though the Nazis' angry nationalism and ardent racism put them on the same side of the fence as many people who embraced not only the political mission of a racially pure, redemptive Aryan future, but also the fairy tale vision of a golden Aryan past full of spiritualism, folk identity, cosmic mysteries, and astrological constructs. Nevertheless, as Goebbels put it, crazy times call for crazy measures, and the Third Reich's waning weeks must have been intensely crazy, not least because its leaders had not yet grasped that their nanosecond of supremacy had already come and gone. And those were the weeks when Hitler turned to prophecy. From the April 1945 diary of Hitler's Minister of Finance, Count Lutz Schwerin von Krosigk, a former Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, we learned that around mid-month, Goebbels and Hitler decided that the time had come to examine two horoscopes, that of the Führer himself, which had been cast in 1933, and that of Greater Germany, cast in 1918. The revelations must have been thrilling. As the diarist writes, both horoscopes had unanimously predicted the outbreak of war in 1939, the victories till 1941, and then the series of defeats culminating in the worst disasters in the early months of 1945, especially the first half of April. Then there was to be an overwhelming victory for us in the second half of April, stagnation till August, and in August, peace. After the peace, there would be a difficult time for Germany for 3 years, but from 1948, she would rise to greatness again. Now I am eagerly awaiting the second half of April. Early on Friday, the 13th of April, 1945, the Reich's State Secretary rang up the finance minister to announce that President Roosevelt had died the previous day. We felt the wings of the angel of history rustle through the room. Schwerin von Krosigk records, "Could this be the long-desired change of fortune? Goebbels thought so. When a reporter told him the news, he called for a bottle of the best champagne and telephoned Hitler to say that just such a turning point had been written in the stars. Goebbels was ecstatic." Less than 4 weeks later, the Nazis surrendered. To the proponents of National Socialism, the discovery of icy little Pluto in 1930 seemed pregnant with implications. Astrologers swiftly integrated Pluto into their horoscopes, and in 1935, 2 years after Hitler became Chancellor of the Third Reich, a German astrologer, Fritz Brunhübner, published a brief but detailed book on the newcomer, Die neue Planet Pluto. According to Brunhübner, Pluto is the end of the old world and the ascent of a new spiritual epoch. It is a malefic in the greatest form, the planet bringing death, the instigator of the turn in world events. Its destiny is to clean up the old and to march before the new era in a new form. But the creepiest connection he makes between Pluto and Hitler's Germany is the following. "Moreover, I believe Pluto to be the planet of National Socialism and the Third Reich. Adolf Hitler and almost all of the leading men now in the government, also the Nazi Party, and the horoscope of the Third Reich, January 30th, 1933, the day of Potsdam, the Reichstag elections of March 5th and November 12th, 1933, show, besides a very dominant Uranus, a strong Pluto. It has to be like this. Pluto is the planet of the turning point. The National Socialistic Movement, in the horoscope of which Pluto is elevated above all other planets, brought about, according to the laws of Pluto, a reversal in German history. And what tells the horoscope of Adolf Hitler? At that moment when Reich President Hindenburg handed Adolf Hitler the fate of the German people, transiting Pluto stood in the zenith, tied to the most important places of the radix horoscope. A trial of strength, a seizure of power, a turning point, a crisis. Turning points keep turning. At the war's end, the Allies dissolved and banned the National Socialist German Workers' Party, and Germany itself now deems the performance of the Nazi salute a criminal offense. In the decades following the war, astronomers found that Pluto is smaller than not only our own moon, but six other moons in our solar system as well. And the International Astronomical Union no longer classifies Pluto as a true planet. The search for sources of sky power, conquest, and new eras must turn elsewhere. Chapter 3. Sea Power. An expanded, ethnically purified Germany, Grossdeutschland, was the vision that drove the Nazis. The lands they intended to conquer had long since been explored, settled, and fought over, their latitudes and longitudes established, their terrain mapped, their rivers traced, their inhabitants identified and named. No such vision impelled the first courageous, curious, or desperate peoples who walked up the Rift Valley, rode and sailed into uncharted tracts of the Pacific Ocean, or rode horses through unknown wastes of the Taklamakan Desert. They had no idea what they were in for. Yet by 40,000 years ago, bands of anatomically modern humans had trekked as far as Sri Lanka and the east coast of China and transported themselves across the sea from Africa to somewhere in Southeast Asia to the then continent of Sahul, a fusion of Australia and New Guinea. Early explorers, gatherers, exiles, sea drifters, traders, and raiders had neither compasses nor maps. Geography and navigation were nascent practices. On land, travelers could follow a river, a mountain pass, or an animal path. On the sea, they could try to stay within sight of land, but had to avoid the subsurface, rocky perils of hugging the shore. Ocean-going wayfinders cataloged and memorized landmarks. They consulted clouds, winds, and sounds for additional clues. They became familiar with swells and currents, phosphorescence, tides, the implications of floating palm fronds and coconut husks, the plants and fishes that dwelled at different depths, variations in the color of the water and in the smell and taste of samples drawn from sediment below the boat. The flight of a bird could reliably indicate land beyond the horizon. A mariner might carry a caged, shore-sighting raven, booby, or frigate bird on board, freeing it periodically to see whether it would return to the dry safety of the boat or head off toward the preferable safety of land. Genesis chapter 8, verse 11 tells us that Noah sent forth a dove, which returned with an olive sprig in its beak. Ancient Polynesians, seeing the long-tailed cuckoo migrate southwestward each year, would have realized it was heading for unseen terra firma because the cuckoo is a landlubber. Taking their cue from the cuckoo and steering southwestward in their twin-hulled voyaging canoes, the Polynesians came upon New Zealand. Medieval Irish monks saw vast honking flocks of geese head northward every spring from their Shannon estuary and return every autumn. Sailing north in their curraghs, they came upon Iceland. Columbus, sighting pelicans en route to what he expected would be the Indies, noted in his log that this bird does not venture more than 20 leagues from land. Once out on the open sea, however, mariners could depend on the sky to tell them where they were. Aside from announcing seasons, the proximity of land, and the weather, the sky signaled location and direction, where the boat was and where it should be heading. In other words, the sky transformed wayfinding into navigation, the haven-finding art. Valued greatly in Europe by the late 16th century, when a mathematics-minded instrument maker in Antwerp penned this definition. This art is divided into two, namely common navigation and grand navigation. The whole science of common navigation is nothing more than knowing perfectly by sight all capes, ports, and rivers, how they appear from the sea, what distance lies between them, and what is the course from one to another. Also in knowing the bearing of the moon on which high and low tides occur, the ebb and flow of the waters, the depth, and the nature of the bottom. Grand navigation, on the other hand, employs, besides the above-mentioned practices, several other very ingenious rules and instruments derived from the art of astronomy and cosmography. A century later, John Seller, hydrographer in ordinary to several British kings, the nation's official surveyor of rivers, lakes, and seas, described navigation as guiding the ship in her course through the immense ocean to any part of the known world, which cannot be done unless it be determined in what place the ship is at all times. And indeed, by his day, the immensity of both ocean and world were well known. Travel books, both factual and fanciful, were perennial bestsellers. Owing to a potent combination of astronomy, mathematics, cartography, literacy, weaponry, instrumentation, navigation, and intimidation, ocean and world had been discovered, explored, charted, inventoried, fictionalized, bought, sold, colonized, grabbed, planted, harvested, and mined, and many millions of the residents forcibly Christianized or enslaved. But there's a backstory. To determine the precise location of his ship, the early navigator needed reliable objects against which to compare his position. But even on a given stretch of sea, a feature that was there in the spring might be absent in the fall. And because the navigator was moving rather than stationary, sailing rather than standing, the reliability factor changed month to month, week to week, even day to day. Since Earth goes around the sun once a year, a stargazer looking upward from the same rooftop once a month at the same time of night sees a sky that has shifted westward 1/12 of 360 degrees or 30 degrees from the previous month's sky. Early astronomers tracked this cycle carefully. Shang Shu, or the Book of History, written in China in the first millennium B.C., states that Taurus rises in the east in the sixth month of the Chinese year, reaches its zenith in the eighth month, and sets in the west in the tenth month, all implicitly at the same hour of night. Kitab al-Fawaid, Fiyusul al-Bahar, Wal-Kawaid, or the Book of Useful Information on the Principles and Rules of Navigation, compiled in the 15th century A.D. in what is now the United Arab Emirates, states that the bright star Canopus sets due west at dawn on the 40th day of the Islamic year and rises due east at dawn on the 222nd day. Another way to think about this cycle is that day after day, decade after decade, a stargazer will see the same stars rise at the same point on the horizon, but they will rise 4 minutes earlier each day. Now, add a much smaller but very real factor to the daily 4-minute and monthly 30-degree changes. The wobble of Earth's tilted axis of rotation at the rate of one full revolution every 25,700 years. Discovered by the ancients, that wobble, called the precession of the equinoxes, has the effect across the centuries of shifting the stars' positions relative to the month of the year. It also affects the North Star. In Homer's time, that star, which today we call Polaris, stood a dozen degrees from the North Pole. In Columbus's time, it stood 3.5 degrees away. In Sputnik's time, it stood right near the pole. By about AD 15,000, as Earth keeps wobbling like a top, Polaris will sit 45 degrees away. When you're sailing the high seas, the slow, centuries-long shifting of Polaris is irrelevant. But not knowing north from east can be fatal. Direction is key. Fortunately, the sun's appearance, disappearance, and midday shadows, as well as the paths taken by other stars and the places from which winds of different character blow, are archetypes of directionality. For example, a bright star named Al-Nilam, corresponding to the center of Orion's belt, rises due east and sets due west. As for finding north in the northern hemisphere, you could look more or less to where Ursa Major, the Great Bear, with its seven bright stars, the Big Dipper, wheels around an axis, neither ascending, culminating, nor descending. The reputedly blind bard Homer, though confused about the northern nighttime sky, knew that stellar navigation would have been important to